This is the Plant on the Line program at thecommentary.ca. I am Anjan Chocolater, sitting in for Joseph Planta. He is the foremost sports book author in Canada today. Stephen Brund has written best-selling and internationally acclaimed books on boxing, baseball, and hockey. His most recent work is Gretzky's Tears, which chronicles the Wayne Gretzky trade in 1988. The book is part history, part biography, and all interesting. Mr. Brund is also a columnist with the Globe and Mail, and can be seen and heard regularly on Canada's most popular sports talk show, Primetime Sports with Bob McCowan. Gretzky's Tears, Hockey, Canada, and the Day Everything Changed is published by Alfred A. Knopf. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Stephen Brund. Good day, Mr. Brund.
Hi, Andrew. How are you doing?
Good, thanks, and welcome to Vancouver.
Yeah, thanks. I'm loving it here.
It's a little too wet today, but what can we do?
I'm shocked by that.
When I first heard about this book, my reaction was it was about time, because other than the 1972 Summit Series, I don't think there's been a bigger story in Canadian sports history than the Wayne Gretzky trade. Why do you think it's taken over 20 years for someone to write a book about this story?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I agree with you. I think it's one of the it's a signpost moment. In sports, obviously in Canada, but I think it extends beyond sports in a lot of ways. And sometimes though. You know, I think sometimes the stories where we're really kind of familiar with them in some way, where they're the Gretzky story per se has been done a million times, and or at least in there was an authorized biography. There's been a lot of fan kind of books about him. I think people at a certain point kind of assume we know it. You know, we know what the story is, and I really thought this one was ripe for revisiting, not just the trade, because there was a lot about the trade I wanted to learn, but I just thought the whole Gretzky story as well. It had been told one way, that story, and kind of which was really the myth, you know, the recurring Canadian myth about small town hockey players, and making the Gretzky story fit that myth. I thought there was a way to kind of look back at Gretzky, sort of like the Orr book, and then to take the trade and all of the things that went into it, all of the things that sprung from it. A lot of great characters. There's a lot of meat culturally, politically, and there's a great hockey player at the center of it who I still think is one of the most unique athletes to emerge in any sport. He's a true original, and that's from my point of view as an author, that's got everything. I was anxious to start it on this one.
Now I understand. Peter Pockington, the Oiler owner who traded Gretzky, has written his own version of these events. Is it purely coincidental that he released his book almost simultaneously as yours?
Yeah, I didn't know anything about it until I was working on this book, and I phoned Pockington, and he said, "I can't talk to you, I'm writing my own book." And that was the first I'd heard about it, and while I was working on this thing, there was kind of, especially when I was in Edmonton, I would occasionally hear something about it, and he had a couple of ghostwriters. He had one originally, he wound up with two, and then it popped up this fall, and I didn't know it was for sure it was coming the same time, but I had an inkling, and it is kind of what I thought it would be. So I invite all of those Peter Pocklington fans out there, I'm sure there's thousands of them, that they should, if they want to read about their hero's version of this, they ought to go buy it.
ESPN just has released a documentary film on the subject, King's Ransom, which I actually saw yesterday, and it's amazing that all these works on this 21-year-old story are coming simultaneously, but independently.
Yeah, wouldn't you thought some of us have got our act together and done another 20th anniversary?
What I was thinking, exactly, yeah.
Well, it did occur to me last year as I was finishing this up that maybe if I'd had some, if I'd planned it a little better, that's what I would have done. But, literally did not occur to me till they started doing all the 20th anniversary retrospectives last August.
The conclusion that I come to after reviewing your chronicle of events leading to the trade was that while Pocklington initiated and orchestrated the trade, an initially reluctant Gretzky was a pretty willing accomplice by the time it occurred, despite the tearful press conference for which this book is named.
I think that's absolutely fair. Gretzky was not naive about his situation in Edmonton, his contract status. He wasn't naive his entire career in terms of money and contracts and his own value. If you look at the way his career played out, he was pretty darn aware of that when he was a teenager, but he had a contract that was going to expire. Pocklington, he was in Edmonton, which was not a major market. He's noted that players were getting big money in places like New York. And he talked about, even, you know, long before the trade, talked about the fact that he understood Pocklington might have to trade him before the end of the deal just to max out, to get some value. Otherwise, Gretzky might walk away for nothing. So he knew it could happen. What he didn't know was the timing, the circumstances. He didn't know that Pocklington and McNaul had begun conversations in the spring of 88. So it caught him by surprise that the deal was effectively done before he knew about it. But the idea of being traded, he was not a surprise to him. And the consequences of it were not negative. You know, they were negative for the Oilers, and they were negative in the sense that a great hockey team was taken apart. But in terms of Wayne Gretzky and his career and his brand and all of those things, it worked out for him pretty darn well.
I think the key moment in negotiations comes at a phone meeting in Kings owner Bruce McNaul's office with Pocklington, with Gretzky present unbeknownst to Pocklington.
Yes, and, you know, this is classic Bruce McNaul, because he was pretty clever about how, you know, human beings work, and that was really the key to a lot of things about Bruce. But he knew, you know, he had enough conversations with Peter Pocklington working up to the deal that he knew that Pocklington wasn't totally enamored with Gretzky's father and with Gretzky's wife, and to some degree with Gretzky. They've been together a long time, but there was a lot of chafing between Pocklington and Gretzky at that point. So he knew that he might well say things about those people if given the opportunity. And, you know, whether or not he needed to do that with Wayne, because, you know, I guess Bruce McNaul could have done the deal whether Wayne Gretzky wanted to do it or not, but Pocklington owned him, he was Pocklington's to sell. But I think Bruce knew that he needed Gretzky on side for what he was trying to do in Los Angeles. He needed him to commit to the project and to effectively be his partner, and he needed him to sever those ties in Edmonton. And so, in the conversation that Gretzky was listening to on the speakerphone, McNaul led him towards Walter and the subject of Walter and Janet and Wayne himself, and Pocklington said a bunch of things, and Gretzky was sitting there in the room listening to them. And I think, you know, in terms of whatever residual loyalty he might have had to the Oilers or to Pocklington, I think that was the end of it right there.
There are a lot of unusual aspects about this trade, at least 15 million of them, and mm-hmm. one being that it evolved at the ownership level on both sides, with general managers Rogge Vachon of the Kings and Glenn Seder of the Oilers both out of the loop, deliberately so, it appears. So this is really two businessmen making a business deal, not two hockeymen making a hockey deal.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The hockey guys, well, Rogge never was a part of it. You know, Rogge seems to have been on vacation the entire time this thing was taking place, and no one felt the need to tell him about anything. Glenn Seder was kept in the dark till the deal was the money part of the deal was effectively done, and there was nothing he could do to change it. And you know, he ended up coming in on the hockey side to try and make the best of it. But it was, you're right. It wasn't a hockey deal. The hockey parts were put in place to make it look like a trade, but it was all about $15 million. It was all about the money that Pocklington needed because he was having issues in his other businesses, and it was all about the money that Bruce McNaul could round up because he had a way of sweet-talking bankers. You know, if those two things don't exist, if Peter doesn't need the money and Bruce can't get the money, the deal would never have happened.
Now, in the aftermath of the trade, many Oiler fans and Canadian media blamed his American actress wife Janet Jones Gretzky for dragging her husband to Los Angeles in a selfish pursuit of her movie career, even though she said she was perfectly happy to raise a family in Edmonton. And given the fact that she did live in Los Angeles and become a stay-at-home mom for the most part and never continued her movie career, you'd have to say she was telling the truth at the time. And in reality, and ironically, it was his first girlfriend, homegrown Edmontonian Vicky Moss, who really chose Hollywood over the great White North and Wayne.
That's right, and of course he trailed her down there, you know, mooning after her when they you know, she went off to pursue her singing career with David Foster. Didn't go very far, but she did try that, and that's what kind of got Gretzky into Los Angeles in the first place, way before Janet Jones. But you know, he had been spending. And you know, one of the things that I didn't know before I went into the book, but to me it was very interesting that, you know, Gretzky had been spending his off seasons there to a large degree. In any case, with Vicky and waiting for Vicky to. They kind of broke up, and he was kind of hoping they would get back together. And he liked it. He liked the place. He liked the fact that he could walk around in L.A., and it wasn't like Edmonton, where in Edmonton everybody knew what everybody was doing, and especially if you're Wayne Gretzky, they knew every move you made. He could be anonymous down there. He hung out Alan Thick was one of the people I talked to for the book, and Thick told me about kind of introducing Gretzky to other famous people, and him enjoying this idea, of being around movie stars and TV stars and music stars. He liked being in the company of celebrities. He liked everything about California. It was a great place for him. It was a good fit. And so, Janet didn't have to drag him there. He met Janet there, and they got together very quickly, and things progressed. But it wasn't about her. I'm not saying she would have been happy in Edmonton. I don't think she would have been. But I think the question was, where was Wayne going to be happy? And I think he was very happy in Los Angeles.
Interwoven throughout this book, as was also the case in the Bob Orr book, is an analysis of the relationship between hockey, the NHL, Gretzky, and Canadian culture. And I guess it's your assertion that these relationships fundamentally changed after this trade.
Yeah, I think they did. I think what changed wasn't hockey, because hockey took a definite turn towards something different after the trade. But hockey, the idea that you'll hear people say still, well, that's when I knew hockey was a business, or that's when hockey became a business. Well, hockey's been a business since the 1920s. At least for owners, because they certainly weren't in it for charitable purposes. They were in it to make money. They certainly exploited hockey players, and they exploited the naivete of hockey players for years. Good Canadian boys who were just happy to not be on the farm anymore and playing hockey for a living. They were underpaid, exploited. You think of the Gordie Howe story in the hockey jacket, where he took a hockey jacket instead of a raise from the Norrises in Detroit. That was the naive Canadian viewpoint, that hockey was this something else, that it wasn't like selling movie tickets, but it was. But I think in that moment, when Gretzky was sold, one of the things Canadians were forced to confront was something that had been true for a long time, which was, this is a bottom line business, that players are commodities, that the guy with the biggest wallet wins. And I know for, watching Gretzky sold to an American, it was like the big rich American comes in and buys our trees, or buys our water, or buys our fish, or some other natural resource, and goes away and rapes the landscape. But that was the reality of the professional sports business. It was just the Canadians had chosen or willingly suspended disbelief, I don't know which, and wanted to think of it as something more benign, a motherhood. A motherhood issue, and maybe it was a loss of it was not a loss of innocence, maybe, but a loss of naivete, certainly.
Yeah, our version of motherhood, an apple pie, I guess.
I think so. Yeah.
Now, your previous book, Searching for Bobby Orr, you call this book somewhat of a sequel. It's well documented that it took a long time before Orr came to terms emotionally with the end of his hockey career, probably because of when and why it ended. I heard somewhere that from the day when Gretzky retired to the day he took over as Phoenix Coyotes coach, which is a little more than 3 years, he never put on skates, even for a twirl with his kids. Does this suggest that he too had trouble coming to terms with the end of his hockey career?
It does. I didn't know that. But it certainly does. I think it does suggest that. And I think one of the... It was interesting when Gretzky got back into coaching in Phoenix. He obviously had other commercial endeavors he was involved with, and he was involved with the Canadian Olympic team, and he had an ownership stake in Phoenix. But what he missed, and I think people who know him very well would tell you the same thing, what he seemed to miss was that being on the road with the boys, having a rooting interest, being really connected to the game. It's only natural. The guy, hockey was his whole existence from the time. Well, almost from birth, there was nothing else. He was a hockey playing celebrity from the time he was 10 years old. It was obviously his destiny from the time he was 10 years old. So to have that just end when you're a relatively young man, and somebody says, "Well, what are you going to do?" Yes, he's rich, but he's probably got a pretty expensive lifestyle. He's not going to go do something else necessarily, go into business, or he's not necessarily equipped to do any of those other things. He's got a grade 10 education. So hockey guys often try and find a way to stay in hockey as long as they possibly can, because it's what they are.
Toward the end of the book, you illustrate how the Gretzky trade directly led to NHL expansion into southern American markets. But what of the argument that the direction the NHL has taken over the last 20 years was inevitable, that if it wasn't Bruce McNall, it was going to be someone like Bruce McNall. If it wasn't Gary Bettman, it was going to be someone like Gary Bettman. If it wasn't the Gretzky trade, it was going to be something like the Gretzky trade, that the fall of the Iron Curtain and the maturation of the Miracle on Ice American generation ballooned the pool of player talent to the point where significant expansion was inevitable.
Well, I guess you could make that case to a degree that they would have, there was a richer talent pool, and maybe there would have been even a natural increase in interest in the United States along with the increase in talent after the Miracle on Ice. But the fact was the NHL had been trying this and failing at expanding to non-traditional markets since the 1960s. It's not like they didn't try to get into places that they weren't before. They went into Atlanta and they failed. The first expansion into Oakland and Los Angeles essentially failed. The Oakland team died and the Kings never were much of a factor. So they had made forays, but they were unsuccessful with it. And I don't know how you could have forced that forward without any kind of glimmer of hope, any example of a team that had gone into a distinctly non-hockey market and succeeded. There really wasn't one. So, maybe. And I'm sure they would have tried, but what happened in L.A. was so dramatic and so instant, and it was so much bigger than hockey. If you think of what the Atlanta Flames ever were in Atlanta, or what the Oakland Seals ever were, the California Golden Seals ever were in the Bay Area, they never had they were nothing. And suddenly, the Kings were almost number one in the biggest market, and one of the biggest markets in North America, and one of the most competitive sports markets in North America. It was the example, I think, of what McNall did there that gave them the confidence to try it, to go ahead. And it was, of course, the greed. the sense that, boy, people are going to pay us $50 million for a team. All those guys were doing the math. All of those owners were doing the division thing. For me, that's X. Found money out of nowhere. I can't imagine how they would have gotten to that point without something as dramatic as Gretzky going to L.A.
One could argue that the NBA on a much smaller scale did with Michael Jordan what the NHL did with Gretzky, riding the temporary wave into uncharted territory, in this case Canada, with, as was the case in the NHL, with mixed results to say the least.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. Obviously they've all over the... I don't think there is a non-basketball market. There's certainly some more or less successful in the U.S., but culturally basketball is pretty much across the board in the United States. In terms of what they did in the foray into Canada and the mixed success, absolutely true. Now they couldn't have done a worse job in Vancouver on every level. Ownership, general manager, really everything. They did everything wrong they could possibly do in Vancouver. So I don't know that the team couldn't have worked in Vancouver with a better game plan. But even in Toronto, where they've had more success, it has been a struggle to extend beyond their core audience. I think there is a good analogy there, that the core audience for basketball in Toronto is probably a lot like the core audience for hockey in some of the American markets.
You also argue that the Gretzky trade led to the demise of the Quebec Nordiques and Winnipeg Jets, but don't you think that the empowerment of the NHL Players Association was going to escalate salaries to the point, along with a plummeting Canadian dollar, that those markets were doomed anyway?
Well, except that you still need the salaries would have only escalated to the point that the market could bear. You still needed the revenue to drive the salary escalation, and I don't think you would have ever had the salary to drive the salary escalation if you hadn't had the expansion money pouring into the league. I think there was a finite amount of money you could generate out of hockey because there was never going to be any great television wealth in the United States. You really needed some kind of an engine to drive that marketplace, whatever the Players Association could do. And I think that money came directly from owners cashing big expansion checks, and I think from owners starting to delude themselves into thinking there was an NFL kind of TV deal coming somewhere down the road. Otherwise, I just don't think there would have been enough money in the system. So if this doesn't happen, and if owners don't start having their pockets filled without having to do anything, I don't think they start spending on salaries. I don't think the salaries increase as dramatically as they did. And I think cities like Quebec and Winnipeg, in theory, could have stayed in the game. You know, they might have had to build new arenas at some point, but there were no great market forces until this trade. I think that would have made it impossible for those teams to exist.
You assert in the book that McNall and Pocklington ushered in a new era in the NHL ownership ranks. Shady businessmen, white-collar criminals, often highly leveraged, coming into the league with other people's money, whether they knew it or not. And a litany of others like John Spanos and Boots Del Biagio would certainly follow. But weren't there such characters before that? Leafs owner Harold Ballard spent time in Millhaven during the 1970s. Tom Scallon, the original owner of the Canucks, spent time at the Crowbar Inn in 1974 while he was still in charge for misappropriating funds. And for that matter, longtime Commissioner Clarence Campbell was convicted of bribery in the 70s.
Yeah, that's true. You know, the Campbell thing, that's true. Ballard was convicted of tax evasion, so I'm not sure he's quite as much. He wouldn't fit in with some of the other fly-by-nighters and fraud artists that we're talking about. Yeah, they had isolated bad guys in the NHL, like you have isolated bad guys anywhere else. But it became. You know, a lot of those teams were owned for years and years. You know, the counterpoint would be that teams were owned for years and years by families or by companies. There was kind of almost institutional ownership in the NHL. Ballard inherited the team because he was partners with Stafford Smythe, who was the son of Conn Smythe. The Molsons forever owned the Montreal Canadiens. The Norris family in Detroit, the Wirtzes in Chicago. Not that they were all the most enlightened owners in the world, but they were kind of square operators, a lot of them. I think when you suddenly had the possibility of real kind of speculative investing in the NHL, like real estate, where people were buying franchises for X dollars because they were assuming that 3 years later the team would be worth three times X, that's when you bring in the hustlers. And it was still the point of entry in the NHL in terms of ownership was lower than in the American professional leagues than in the NFL or in baseball or even in the NBA. So you get a guy who is not as wealthy it allows entry. It's an entry point league in a lot of ways. So you got guys who are undercapitalized compared to, say, what an NFL owner would be, who thought they were going to make a big score, who thought they were getting in on the ground floor of something, and that's the perfect circumstance to set up a pyramid scheme. There were elements of that in the expansion game. We're going to dictate that our franchises are worth X because that's what we can get for them. If that's what they're worth, then my franchise is worth that too, and I can go to my banker and say I suddenly have an NHL team that's worth, you know, now I bought it for $10 million, now it's worth $50 million. You know, loan me money on that basis. It was in many ways a financial house of cards, and I think you could argue that it's still a financial house of cards.
Getting back to Gretzky, if I was the owner of the Phoenix Coyotes and Wayne Gretzky is handing me his daily organizer for tens of millions of dollars and equity in the franchise, I can think of a lot of useful things he could do. Sign autographs, kiss babies, shake hands, make appearances. But it turns out he did none of that. People in Phoenix say that he was basically a recluse away from the rink. Maybe one of the least useful things he could do for me would coach the team. How do you explain his indifference or unwillingness to promote a team that obviously needed a lot of promoting?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Like, I understand, you know, the one thing I do understand is that at the end, when they were desperate, when Jerry Moyes was in big trouble, that Gretzky took the opportunity to exert his leverage and get an $8 million coaching contract. That was born out of Jerry Moyes' ignorance about hockey and his desperation to do something to try and fix it. And, you know, somebody saying to him, and probably, you know, maybe it was Gretzky saying, why don't you let Wayne coach the team? That'll get people out. Which is, I don't care who coaches the team. No one pays. There's never been a coach in history that anyone paid to watch. But in terms of his indifference promoting teams, I got to say, I didn't know that. It does seem to work contrary to his own interest, though, because he had an equity stake in the franchise. He's also been. You got to think about this. He is a guy who has been in the Wayne Gretzky business for his entire life. He had all kinds of other things that he would have been hustling on the side. You know, various endorsement deals and stuff like that. He would be working the brand in Canada, selling cars and wine and everything else he could put his name to. So, you know, the Coyotes were only one part of the Wayne Gretzky business, and maybe that's why they didn't get his full attention.
I understand that U.S. purchasers of this book will see a different title on the cover.
Apparently so. Yeah, that's one of those things that was out of my hands. But you know what? It's okay because it rings equally true. I think it's Gretzky's Tears, Hockey America, and the day everything changed. And it's I'm okay with that. It's I think for maybe Joe Average American, not much changed the day that Wayne Gretzky was sold to the LA Kings. But I think for anybody who had even an inkling of interest in hockey, a whole lot of things changed for them as well. But the book itself, the text, is not changed. So any American who buys it is going to get a short course in Canadian culture here, I think.
Well, Searching for Bob Uecker was the number one bestseller in this country, and there's no reason why this shouldn't follow. A fascinating look back for older fans who lived during the Gretzky era, like myself, and for younger fans who didn't see him play or play in his prime. Continued success to you in all your endeavors. We can't wait for your next book. And thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks, Adrian. It was a real pleasure talking to you today.
This has been the Plant Online Show for thecommentary.ca. I'm Ann Jan Chocolater.